Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. In the next half an hour, from the Netherlands to Britain, we visit the seafood bar in London Soho, the first foreign outpost for the much-loved Dutch restaurant group.
To keep the prices good, to have the love for the seafood, the love for your teams, and be involved everywhere, that's why we had the possibility to open maybe 10 or 20.
Also ahead, we have a longer look at what's making news in the Latin American food and drink front. Fernando, what can we expect today?
Marcos, I'll give you a brief of some very rare Brazilian ingredients and also a few news from wine in the region.
Thank you, Fernando. And of course, we'll hear a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. The Seafood Bar is a Dutch family operation with four restaurants across the Netherlands. The company has just gone international by launching its first restaurant abroad. The new Seafood Bar is placed in London's Soho, offering the same towering seafood platters that brought the company so much fame at home. I visited the restaurant a bit earlier to speak to the father of the family running the business, Fons de Fischer. He began by explaining how he got into the restaurant game after almost 30 years as a fishmonger.
Well, after 27 years, children were grown up and came from university, started to work themselves. And I was 50. Now, you can do two things, or just go on, but that wasn't the plan. Or find another wife, another car, younger wife, Porsche, or do something else. So my idea was, let's move to Amsterdam. And so I told my wife, let's move to Amsterdam. She was, oh, it's okay, nice. So we moved from Helmond to Amsterdam, and we sold everything in the south in Helmond. We lived in Amsterdam then, but I didn't have enough money to stop working. So I had to think about something else. So it took me half a year, and then I thought, okay, the seafood bar, that will be a nice idea. And then I started looking for a venue, and I found one in really the best neighborhood of Amsterdam, outside. And there I started the seafood bar, the first one I built myself, totally, together with my brother-in-law. Took us 3 months, and then we had a seafood bar like this, smaller, but similar like this. And we opened the door, and we started the seafood bar.
And it did go rather well, because now you have four in the Netherlands, and now this London restaurant is your fifth one.
That's correct. This is our fifth one. So I think one restaurant, that also has to do because my children came in. My daughter was studying artificial intelligence, and she was ready with that. And then she had to wait 3 months for a new period on another university. She came to me and said, can I stay with you for 3 months? Then I help you in the seafood bar. Said, no, it's fine, come over. She never left. Then my son sold his IT company and was going to travel. And before he left, I said to him, well, maybe, Pep, if we find another nice spot, are you coming back then and take care of the back office? He studied economics. So after several months, I called him and I said, you have to come back. I have a new nice place to start a beautiful restaurant, big, 200 covers. So a few weeks later, he was back, and we started the second one, and then third.
And fourth, and now fifth over here. So we are now at your restaurant in London on Dean Street. Tell me about the concept of the seafood bar.
The concept of the seafood is really easy. We have a line I thought about when I started the first seafood bar. It was the simplicity of the lekkerbek. And a lekkerbek, that's Dutch. As somebody who really loves food, but it's also a fried fish. So if you can fry this simple fish, like for a fish and chips, and make that perfect, then you understand the concept of the seafood bar. Because we like to work with simple products, really fresh products, but not too much done with it. And then I think it's okay, because people like it really. And then the other thing is, our prices are, I think, normal. So it's not really high-end prices, but high-end products. So like lobster, we sell a whole lobster for 30 to 50 pounds here in London. of course, I did some research, and other places all asking 45 or something like that. So we like to have more guests, make less money on it, but more guests, so at the end.
So it's about the scale as well?
It's also about the scale, yes, that's right.
Now tell me about the menu. What kind of things? You have the same menu over here as you have in the other restaurants in the Netherlands. What are the highlights over there?
The highlights over there in the Netherlands is the Frit de Mer. So that's a cold platter, eyes on it, and all shells, lobster, crab, king crab, oysters, like you eat in Normandy, Bretagne, in France. And the other one is the mixed grill. Then you have also, I believe, seven different kind of fish and mussels, and all kind of things. It's a great dish to share, so people can sit there and can just talk to each other, drink a glass of wine, eat it with their hands, because you can't actually not eat it with a fork. So you have to eat with your hand. That makes it feel at home, like you sit at home and with friends on a table.
Now tell me, what kind of business lessons can you share with our listeners? Obviously, there are many seafood restaurants and bars around the world, but what has made your business so successful?
Well, that's a question I ask myself also many times. But I think to keep the prices good, to have the love for the seafood, the love for your teams, and be involved everywhere. That's why we had the possibility to open maybe 10 or 20, because investors are lining up to give money. But we do everything ourselves, and we like to be involved with our team. I like to know their names, and we teach it themselves. And yeah, for the rest, I don't know. I love seafood.
I think it's interesting, you know, when you mentioned that you want to be involved and kind of be involved in all aspects of the business, because I think there are some people who might accuse you of micromanaging.
Yes, that's right. They do. You're totally right. But what else do I have to do? Go play golf or something? And we have our back office who takes care of the contracts, who takes care of the legal things and everything. So this is hobby for me more, and I like it, so why not?
Fair enough. How important is it for you that this place feels Dutch?
I think feel Dutch is not necessary, but the seafood bar feeling and vibe, that's important. That is what we will bring here. But if it's the Dutch way, then the south of Dutch, they're famous for their hospitality and everything. So we come from the south of Holland, near the border of Belgium, so they know how to eat, they love food, and so do we. And that's why we bring also the name Amsterdam in it. And the other thing is, of course, really, really a lot of people from London, from the UK, have been in our restaurants. It's crazy how many people I had already in the restaurant last week. And then they come in. Yesterday there was a guy was walking by. He said, seafood bar, and he asked, is this the same one as in Amsterdam? I said, yes. Oh, great. I'll make a picture, send to my wife. Because we've been in Amsterdam. Last night, we had an older couple, I think around 70. They were for their honeymoon or something like that. They were in Amsterdam. They have been 3 days in Amsterdam and 3 days in the seafood bar. And they were sitting over there, and it was just a nice thing. And they recognized me, so that it was more like, oh, great. And
that's amazing. I wonder, what's that one factor that you took into account when making the decision where to launch this place? You could have gone somewhere maybe a bit easier within the EU, for example. You could have gone to France. You could have gone to, I don't know, Germany.
Yeah, okay, but it's the language. It is because English, yeah, my English is not that well, but for the most people, and for me, I understand almost everything, so that's easy. France is a difficult language. German's okay, that's also something, but I have no connection to Germany. And to London, I've been many times in London, and my son lives in London now. And the transport, of course, it's 50 minutes with the plane and 4 hours with the train. So that's also really easy if there's no COVID.
I know COVID. Let's for once not talk about COVID, shall we? But tell me about what it's like to launch a restaurant in another country. Obviously, you know, you talk about how important sustainability is for you when you are sourcing seafood, and also you want to offer great produce. So what's it like in terms of those logistics to find the right suppliers and the right partners to work with?
Well, you start at the beginning and go to call them, and then you go to their places and you ask them for a tour through their business. So I went to, I think, 10 wholesale companies, And I talked to the owner or to the managers, and I asked them, can you show me your place? And can we talk about sustainability? How are you working with this? And then I started with that in the end of April. And so the past months, I found out who I like to go to work. So that's what we do now. We told them our volumes in the Netherlands from a similar restaurant. So I hope they can supply us in that. But Monday, there was bank holiday. So that was a problem because that's difficult. But that works really well. So I know the owners now from the companies where I buy from. I know them personally, the owners.
I'm doing this interview right before you are about to launch this restaurant. It is open now, but it's soft launched, so there's not maybe as many people at the moment as there will be when you open for real. What kind of situation have you had with staffing?
There's different problems. One is the construction was 6-7 weeks late, so we hired staff for early July, and then there was no work for them here, so they've found another job, so we had to start over. So that was one problem. And the other problem, it's not easy to find good stuff here. Because of Brexit, lots of Italians, Spanish people are back home.
Are you going to get some support from the home country?
Yep. Next Sunday, some really experienced chef is coming from Amsterdam over here to train the kitchens, to train the service. And they stay for a couple of months, so that's good. It was one of the ideas, but that was from before Brexit, to let them exchange. So people from London can go for a month or 2 or 3 months to Amsterdam. From Amsterdam, we can bring them to London. But because of Brexit, again, but that's not the problem now. So we fixed something, I don't know exactly, but we did so.
So just finally, what kind of plans do you have for the future? So now that you have opened this restaurant in London, what's next in the pipeline? Do you have a dream of going to other countries?
No, that's not really at this moment in the picture, because first we have to have this working really well. And so maybe another one is coming in London. But I think if we have a really nice place here, we can have a nice life ourselves. We can have everything organized. We can come over. We can have our lunch here, dinner in Amsterdam. So
sounds very good. So I have to ask from you, considering that you have almost 30 years of experience as a fishmonger and you are in charge of this restaurant. When people come here for the first time, what should they order?
I try to find out first. I have a look. Are you young, old? If it's a really big plate, then I'll tell them, now, maybe you should choose this. But the most of the times, I try to sell some oysters because we have really amazing oysters. And or the Frie de Mer, because that's one of our specialities. And for the other things is I try to find out what they like. If you come here and say, what can you recommend me? Then for you, I go for the mixed grill because you're a big guy. You can you can enjoy it, but older people, maybe it's too much, and then they think it's a waste, so much food. And so I bring then the starters, finger foods, and we have really nice crab cakes and some vongolen in a garlic sauce and, you know, the smaller dishes, and then you can also taste really a lot of different things.
So mixed grill for me.
Mixed grill for you.
Vonster Fischer there. He runs the seafood bar with his family, and the new London restaurant is open now. You are with The Menu on Monocle 24. This week, instead of the usual quick roundup of headlines from around the world, we focus on what's happening in the food, drink and hospitality sector in Latin America. And for that, I'm joined by a super duo. Monocle's LATAM correspondent Lucinda Elliott is in Montevideo, and here at Midori House Studio 1, I'm joined by our senior culture correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who, as you probably know by now, hails from Brazil. Welcome to the program. Lucinda, shall we start with you? We have some big news from Latin America. The latest person to win the title of the world's best female chef hails from Peru.
Yeah, so 50 Best Restaurants has awarded their female prize to Peruvian chef Pia León. She runs Lima's Coye and is the co-owner of Central, which she runs with her husband. And for at least a decade now, that restaurant's been recognized by all sorts of international foodies. And her first solo endeavor is what really got her this year's award. It was launched 3 years ago in Lima. The set menu, I'm told, is all about seasonal ingredients, indigenous flavors, food specific to the Andean and Amazon regions. And the name Coye itself is actually taken from a local orange flower that grows at very high altitudes. And along with Central, the restaurants are all about showcasing some of Peru's lesser known ingredients, a nod to what Fernando might go on to later on in the program.
How big news do you think this is for the country, for Peru, and say for its tourism industry?
Well, I think Peru has always been a standout in Latin America. It's really sort of led the charge when it comes to promoting their cuisine. You know, you go around now and things like ceviche are so widely available. I understand through the pandemic, obviously, that Peru suffered very badly, that they've obviously been restricted in terms of people actually going there. But I feel that the prize to Pia León really sort of has solidified that, as I say, for at least a decade now, the country has really stood out in Latin America.
Fernando, the next story is from you, and it's funny that Lucinda mentioned those ingredients, because next I want to hear about this book you've been looking at. It's a new book about Brazilian cooking and Brazilian ingredients.
It's a very interesting book by writer Joyce Galvão, and the interesting thing, Marcus, she talks more about some Brazilian ingredients that even many Brazilians don't know. And to be honest, while I was reading, having a look at the book, many of them I don't know, Marcus. And it's so weird, because there's a classic example here in the book. You know, before Christmas, Brazilians, they go and buy cherries in the supermarket, and they can be fairly expensive actually in Brazil. They're not native. But she was saying, you know what, we do actually have our own type of cherry called Grumichama. I know it's quite...
Have you tasted many Grumichamas?
I actually didn't know it existed, and it is from Brazil, and this happens so often. There's another one called Cumaru, which is kind of a Brazilian spice. Apparently it tastes like vanilla, but I haven't tried. And I think what I hope for the Brazilian cuisine, and I think Joyce might agree with me, that hopefully those ingredients will become a little bit more common nationwide, because we even have some restaurants in São Paulo which they have Brazilian cuisine with ingredients for the Amazon, and it's quite expensive. It's not something that is the day-to-day kind of food for Brazilians. So I think it's an excellent book with so many different things that I had no idea existed.
Why do you think it is that people don't seem to know Brazilian ingredients that well then? I'm wondering, you know, thinking about Scandinavia, for example, where I hail from, I would imagine that I pretty much know what that region has got to offer in terms of ingredients. Is it that in Brazil you kind of have a European mindset when it comes to cooking and you don't use local ingredients that much?
I think so, and perhaps we play quite safe. You know, as Lucinda was saying, Peru has this kind of amazing status, you know, because of its culinary, I mean, which is amazing, actually. It's quite impressive. I love Peruvian food. But I do think Brazil could have been that, but I think our food is quite safe. When I ask people, what do you know about Brazilian cuisine? They mention feijoada, our bean stew, or a lot of meat, which of course, that's what we eat. But I think there's so much more to explore. And to be honest, not only internationally, even locals, I have to explore. Next time I go to Brazil, Marcus, I'll be trying those grumichamas. I mean, the name is quite difficult, actually.
For those people actually who want to find out more, I would imagine this book is out in Portuguese. Do you want to give us the name of it?
Yes, it's by Joyce Galvão, and it's called Ingredientes para uma Confeitaria Brasileira. Ingredients for kind of a Brazilian cuisine. Hopefully she should release the book in English. I'll talk to her.
Hopefully, I look forward to that. Lucinda, let's continue with you. I understand that you've been looking at what's happening in the LATAM wine market.
So first of all, sticking to Peru, the other week, a lovely vineyard from the Pisco Valley, where the traditional spirit is made, got in touch about their new project to make natural wine, Bodega Murga, that began producing Pisco back in 2014, south of Lima, has launched several natural wines that vary in colour from sort of clearer reds and rosés to what they've called the Sofia L'Orange, inspired by actress Sofia Loren. And they're all free from pesticides. The wine that I'm yet to taste myself is actually served at Central restaurant that I mentioned, but something really new for this part of the continent, Peruvian wine. You know, what next? Galapagos, Chablis. But yes, and then also looking to Uruguay, where I am, it might come as a surprise to some listeners, but Uruguay is a real trailblazer when it comes to high quality wines. Argentina and Chile, of course, are the ones with big scale production. But vineyards like Garçon along the eastern coast here, which is entirely sustainable, and where Chef Francis Malman has a restaurant, have really helped to reposition the country internationally with award-winning bottles. And now actually all eyes are on China. Uruguay already exports pretty much half of all its beef to China, primarily very expensive cuts. And so they're now hoping that wine might be another area to showcase. You know, the Chinese, as we're aware, in recent years have become big fans of Cabernets, of champagne, you know, as well as other Western goods like olive oil that Uruguay produces locally. So there's a real push from the government here. And already on Tuesday, the president, Lacayo Pou, announced a preliminary outline of a possible free trade agreement with China. So you can see that the links between the two countries are strengthening.
It sounds like there is so much happening when it comes to the wine industry in Latin America. What do you expect from the future then? Obviously, as you mentioned, we have the idea that Argentina and Chile are the countries where the wine comes from, but that idea may be quite old-fashioned soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly Uruguay, with this possible free trade agreement with China, it's really rattling neighbours and the big wine producers like Argentina, who make up the Mercosur trade bloc. And they don't really like that little Uruguay is sort of making moves outside the club. And obviously, Argentina is going through an extreme economic downturn, and they've got a lot of restrictions in terms of what they can export. So I think we could see a shift here, and particularly in the sort of the tastes and what's on offer. What's interesting about Uruguay is they produce wines like Albariño, for example, that I'm told is sold in all sorts of decent wine shops in London, in São Paulo, and in bigger cities in the United States. So these quite specialist wines, and really raising sort of the level of what's offered, less like the Chileans, particularly, that, you know, have this quite sort of mass produced wine that we find in the likes of Sainsbury's.
Fernando, what about your country, Brazil? What do you think about the wines coming from there? You have wine industry.
We do have. I mean, it's growing. Of course, it doesn't compare to the Chilean or the Argentinian one, but, you know, it is growing. And one interesting thing, Marcus, there's been a new study. Finally, we're having this type of studies because finally we're having quite a lot of consumption of wine. Last year was, I think, the best year in terms of Brazilian drinking wine ever. I don't know if it was the quarantine, the lockdowns, but there, every time I go back to São Paulo, there's more and more wine bars. You just notice that. In the past, to be honest, Brazilian wine had a terrible reputation, I have to say. But now we're having some excellent wineries, especially in the south of the country. And in this study, they're saying that the biggest consumption per capita is in the southern states, especially Rio Grande do Sul. Although São Paulo, where I come from, perhaps of its size, we are kind of the biggest market for wine. But it's still very much a southern or southeast kind of, who knows, maybe people from the northeast, in the north as well, they should enjoy a little bit more. And there's been some interesting stats, Marcus. Brazilians do like red wine. Apparently, 82% said that that's the preferred one. And even some people say they divide it between sexes as well. Women and men prefer red wine, and they like the dry one. They didn't specify which type of grape. And I have to say, I do like dry red wine.
Exactly. And when you go back home to São Paulo, are you touring those wine bars? So are you still looking for caipirinhas?
Well, I do love a caipirinha. And, you know, every time I go, it's usually in the summer. But my father is a big fan of wine, so we tend to drink some lovely red wine. But next time I'll talk to my father, and I think he should also explore more Brazilian wineries, because from what I've been hearing, there's some excellent ones. And you know what? I should be a little bit more of a patriot for that.
Now, Fernando, be honest when you answer this question. What do you think about the drinking culture in the UK or more widely in Europe? Are there many drinks you miss or that you find difficult to find?
Perhaps I'm not the biggest lover of pints. I do miss some kind of more easily available frozen margaritas, you know, Marcus, or any type of frozen drinks. I know I am a little bit cheesy when it comes to drinks, but that's exactly what I miss. And I miss the Brazilian shop as well. I think Lucinda knows that. I think a pint's too big for me. A shop is slightly smaller and kind of a thinner glass with ice cold beer. That's what I miss.
Lucinda, when you are in Montevideo, what about you? Is there anything you miss from Britain?
I actually would say the complete reverse. I miss a pint as well. I think the sort of beer drinking culture is very much sort of out of bottles, sort of litre bottles that you share around, and it's not your individual glass. It's all about sharing. Cider as well is one that I feel the Latin American market, it's almost impossible to find. And when you do find it, it's unbelievably sweet. And I think that might be something that they should look into. Uruguay, for example, is a big apple producer. So I'd be curious, yeah, a really lovely apple cider pint, packet of crisps. I miss that.
Lucinda and Fernando, thank you very much. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show Food Neighbourhoods for great recipes. This show was researched by Charlie Phil McCourt and Sophie Monaghan Coombs and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Marcus Hippi. Once again, we finish this programme with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is Pablo Vittar with Triste Com Ti. Thanks for listening. Linda de calcinha pra te seduzir. Lingerie vermelha e um vinho do bom. Toda suadinha e você gosta assim. Deixo tua mente naquele frisão. E cadê você que não está aqui? Duas